Hi, this is Paul, and I wanted to make a video on choosing beliefs. Peter Boghossian, who is now famous for his hoax papers, along with James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose, teaches philosophy at Portland State University, I believe. He's also famous for being a celebrity atheist, and he wrote a manual for creating atheists, and so he works in this area of belief. And I noted that he tweeted, and then he actually tagged me in it, a conversation he's starting with another philosopher surrounding the question of choosing beliefs. And I saw that and I thought I'd really like to make a little video about this because it's a topic that interests me considerably. Partly because this is very much a pastor's job. What do? Pastors try to convince people to believe, which we'll talk about as conscious subscription, to a set of beliefs that are usually represented by doctrines. Pastors also try to encourage people to conform their behavior to a set of behavioral norms, usually represented by standards or laws or rules. And pastors try to do this in the context of community and try to do this with multiple people at the same time, often with one touch a week or two touches a week. And what I mean by that is they might hear a sermon, they might meet with me in my office, I might visit them in their home, they might discuss a problem, it might be a casual conversation after worship service, but all of this is happening in this context, and so pastors very much are involved in the practice of stewarding, shepherding, pastoring people's beliefs. And pastors, as much as anyone, know how difficult and often futile these efforts are. Now, in the last video I made, had both John Vervaeke, who is a professor of psychology at University of Toronto and has been doing a series on the meaning crisis. In episode 13, he talked about the relationship between belief and behavior. I had a clip from Tim Keller, who is vice president of the Gospel Coalition, a celebrity pastor, founder of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, who is teaching a course at the Gospel Coalition on how to change people's hearts in the seats through preaching. And he also talked about the difference between conscious subscribed beliefs and behaviors or motivations or things in the heart. And as I said before, pastors deal with this all the time. And I dealt with both of these videos in the context of Jordan Peterson and his now very famous refusal to say the words, "I believe in God," because people out there won't fully appreciate what it means to believe something, or necessarily he doesn't want his definition of God syncing up with their preconceived notions of God. So I dealt with that in the last two videos I made. Just last night, Peterson dropped his April question and answer. It was I love his question and answer videos. They're very, very interesting. But here in this video, he had a tiny little section on, I believe it was the question of if he had a chance to talk to Nietzsche, what would he talk about? But Peterson very, you know, goes into the question of how we are mysteries to ourselves, how in many ways the things that are moving are, and I describe them, the things that are inside of us are black boxes to us. We come up with ideas and we do things that we think, well, why did I do that? That was counterproductive. That was self-destructive. Why did I say that? No, the Bible talks about this kind of thing a lot. Romans 7 in particular, where Paul talks about the good that I would do, I don't do, and the evil that I don't want to do, I do. The book of James talks about the tongue. Who can tame the tongue? The tongue lights a field on fire, and that's what we do with our lives. And so Peterson very famously tries to govern his speech and not lie and do all of these things in order to in a sense manage himself, because most of us have the experience of being poor managers of ourselves. And as a pastor, I have a degree of responsibility for stewarding a flock and helping them in their desire of self-mastery. But even that idea is so fraught, because what is the self that is trying to master this other thing? And so there have been various conceptions of this. One of my favorite ones is Jonathan Haidt, the writer, Jonathan Haidt's The Rider and the Elephant, where the human being is conceived of, you can find this in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, the human being is conceived of as a rider and an elephant, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But Peterson talks about these kinds of things in a very engaging way, I'll say. And this is just a pretty standard clip of him doing
you
know, that.
You learn to kind of watch yourself like you're watching a stranger, but you have to adopt a position. It's a position of radical humility, I would say, both humility in two senses. So one sense would be the humility of recognizing your ignorance. So you have to understand that you don't know who you are. And that's not easy to understand because you think you know. But then, you know, you remember you can't control yourself very well. You're not very disciplined. You're full of flaws. Maybe you don't know yourself as well as you think. But it's hard to get low enough to understand how deeply it is the case that you are ignorant about who you are. Now, there's an upside to that, too, which also is that you're also ignorant about who you could be. And so the discovery of that, you know, is some reward for the horror of determining who you actually are. And then I would say, well, then you watch yourself. You know, and you attend to your conscience and you see, you watch yourself like you're watching a stranger. You watch what you say and you listen.
And this capacity for split self is very interesting when it comes to beliefs, because we would say, well, I believe these things. And in a sense, we take on an identity. We say, I am this thing. And then as Peterson is describing here, we discover that this let's use the rider and the elephant, this rider that in a sense takes ownership of this, discovers that the elephant that greatly outweighs and outmuscles the rider isn't necessarily going to listen. And so you have this back and forth, this to and fro, but then you have the realization that I am in many ways multiple people. And I've described this before as kind of my consciousness congress. And I imagine it sort of like a body politic, because there are factions and there are motivations and there's all this stuff, and it's not necessarily it's definitely not transparent to me, but it's in me, and and Jonathan Pichot is good with this stuff. It forms up into a hierarchy of sorts, and this again is where, when you get into Peterson's book, the question of the world conceived of as a space of objects or a form for action, time and action demand that the conscious act. And so things come, and the conscious self of me that has all of these subscribed beliefs violates its own tenets. And we see that all the time.
You think, well, what sort of person would say that? And how am I reacting emotionally when I'm communicating in that manner? You know, is that making me feel stronger, weaker? Is it filling me with shame? Is it helping my confidence? Am I laying out a lie? Am I deceiving myself and other people? Am I adopting this personality at parties that is designed to impress and to amuse, and it comes across as nothing but like self-centered narcissism? What are my dark fantasies? What are my aggressive fantasies? What is it that I'm willing to do? What am I interested in so that I'll spontaneously pursue it? What do I procrastinate about and why? What am I unwilling to do? What do I think is good? What do I congratulate myself for accomplishing? And what do I berate myself for failing to confront and to implement? Those are all incredibly complicated questions, and you don't know the answers to them. So that's a start. And then in terms of potential, well, you'll discover a little bit more about your potential as you discover who you are, especially the darker parts of yourself, because then you discover your potential for mayhem. There's some real utility in that, you know, a discovery that you're dangerous. It's such a useful discovery. It's actually something that strengthens you, because the first thing that a realization like that can in fact produce is the the ambition to incorporate that danger into a higher order personality, that dangerousness into a higher order.
Okay, now when he's talking about incorporating and integrating, we're talking about basically setting up a hierarchy, but it's a disciplined functional hierarchy. And so when he's talking about integrating or incorporating, it's really more than, I mean, the metaphor makes it sort of sound like moving around boxes on an organizational chart. But as we get into this video, that's really what you're doing is training. And that's the rider training the elephant. And it's the rider, in a sense, who is the conscious, rational part of the entire organism, which is the rider and the elephant, where they're both, this is where actually the rider actually begins to be able to learn how to control the elephant and make the whole thing work together. But now, obviously, that's within a communal context and a social context.
Order personality, and that can make you implacable. That can make you someone who can say no when you need to say no. You know, that can make you someone who won't avoid necessary conflict. And so that's just unbelievably useful.
And in the ancient world, riders and elephants were really super weapons if you could train the elephant. And so that's a big part of this. But Peterson, I think rightfully, Peterson just does great riffs on these kinds of things. That's part of the reason he's so popular, and he's got great lists when he goes through them. Now, conscious, subconscious, unconscious. This is just what Google scraped. But it's not bad. Many people use unconscious or subconscious interchangeably as a noun. If a person has fallen asleep or been knocked out, they are unconscious, not subconscious. If a person is alert but doesn't realize they are thinking or doing something, the thought or action is subconscious, not unconscious. And I'm not a psychologist. Verveke or Peterson or many who know psychology could probably go into this better. But what this recognizes is that we have all of these forces working within us that impact this thing we call belief. Now we're going to have to do a little bit of defining here, because I think what we really have here are two competing ideas that we are using the same word for, which is belief. And part of this is what goes on with Jordan Peterson when he, you know, kvetches about having to answer the question whether he believes in God. One thing that we talk about beliefs are statements to which you consciously and often communally subscribe. They are often aspirational. You know, I believe in God. And again, pastors know this, and this is common stuff that comes out in sermons. We admonish people to act up to their beliefs and live up to their professions and live up to the communal standards that their religious community or their political community. We're having a lot of these conversations now with respect to lying and truth telling and corruption. I just read David Brooks' take on the Mueller report. So, you know, there's just all of these things. And so we admonish people to live up to their beliefs. And they say, well, I believe in God. I trust in God. Well, then trust in God. But trusting and acting is a funny thing. So they're often religious. There's often accountability involved. There are often statements about ideas and statements, worldview statements about how we think the world is. They're resolutions about behavior, and these are all this. That's all located in a sense in this conscious realm that we possess. But as we know, in terms of who we are, that's just a tiny part of us. That's just this conscious self, and you can think about it as sort of a subcommittee in your consciousness congress. And different groups are going to be coming in there and taking hold of the wheel sometime. So then there's these other beliefs. And so when Peterson says, well, I don't listen to what people say they believe, I see what they do. And so these are these axioms, and they're sort of like laws of physics, in that we watch for patterns. And this is where Peterson says, watch yourself as if you're a stranger. Kind of do this third person disassociation and start tracking yourself. And so my wife is, you know, sometimes people keep a little food record. Now, you know everything that you put in, but when you kind of keep a food diary, you begin to notice, well, here's what I've been eating. Or keep a journal or keep a diary, and you take like this third person thing, and you start to this third person posture, and you start to analyze yourself, and then you begin to realize that you have this other set of beliefs underneath that are disconnected from your conscious beliefs. But now, is belief the right word for that? Or we're using, I think we're using the word beliefs on both ends, because it's a very helpful tool to say, well, this is what I say I believe, but this is what I often do. And so if you listen to David Nasser and Jordan Peterson's conversation and One More Question, that's exactly what Nasser is doing. And this is, in fact, exactly what religions do and organized religions do, because we say, okay, these are the things that are supposed to describe how we intend to live. And if we take a third person, if we take a third person perspective on ourselves, these are the things we are actually doing. And actually we watch each other very carefully with respect of this. And in The Happiness Hypothesis, Jonathan Haidt actually has a very good section on gossip, where he talks about, you know, gossip, generally speaking, in religious communities has a bad connotation, but it's often a critical, it's a critical aspect of human community by which we hold each other accountable. And as a pastor, I know it's always easier to see the sins of others than to see my own sin. And Jesus talks about that with respect to first take the log out of your own eye before you try to take the speck out of the eye of your neighbor. And Jesus has incorporated into this little word picture the biases, the self-serving biases that make us such bad judges of ourselves. And so that's part of the reason we take these axioms and we use the same word of we use the same word belief for them, so we can kind of line them up. And Jordan Peterson and others see these as your true beliefs. And that's why we use the same word, so we can line them up. And then they downvote the conscious rider talk. Well, you say you're a Christian, but you don't blah, 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 blah. And this is where hypocrisy becomes such a vital and powerful social tool, because we can, we all strive to be persons of integrity. What does integrity mean? Which means everything is integrated within us. But we are not people of integrity, because the chattering writer says, here are the beliefs I subscribe to. And the rest of us are watching and we're saying, I can discern your true beliefs. I can discern the things that are really governing your heart. And again, if you go back and watch the Tim Keller video on preaching to the heart, this is what he describes with the 15-year-old girl that says, yeah, I know I'm a Christian, but none of the boys like me. And so now you have the idea coming into of idolatry, that you say, well, I worship the Lord, but money really has my heart. And what Tim Keller is using in that clip is that heart is kind of the center of the human motivational system. This goes all the way back to Augustine, who will say, you are what you love. And James K.A. Smith, a philosopher at Calvin College, he's been moving that, he's been working that part of the field for a few years now. So they downvote the conscious rider talk and they upvote the third person observation. And that's why Peterson says, watch yourself, because people are going to be doing this to you anyway. So if you actually want to improve and be a more integrated human being and have more integrity, do that process ahead of them. And again, religious communities, community is so helpful for things like this. And it, because it happens automatically in community with respect to status and gossip and performance and duplicity and hypocrisy and sacrificial goodness. All of these things are at play. And so if you actually have a conscious community that says, these are the beliefs we ascribe to, well, then you've actually got something that you can work with to improve yourself. And this is why having, and you know, this is why churches have, and religious groups, if you really want to improve a person, you have to do it communally. And AA has known that for years. Do we choose our beliefs? Well, we sort of choose these, we choose these statements to which we consciously and communally subscribe, and they are often aspirational. And so when we're asking the question, do we choose our beliefs, I would have to ask, what do you mean by beliefs? That sounds like pulling a Peterson here. These statements about ideas, these resolutions about behavior. The beliefs of the elephant is going to go his own way, because these beliefs that we discern, these beliefs that we then label on other people, well, those are the beliefs that we're seeing from a third party perspective. And basically we'd say we choose one set of beliefs, but not another. Which set is most true? Well, again, it depends on what you mean, what frame of reference you're trying to look at. So now, and again, beliefs is too undifferentiated a word. Now, it's important for our own physical survival that we don't choose our beliefs, because I believe I see a truck driving down the road on Florin Road, and so I'm not going to walk in front of it. It's very important for us, just in terms of our survival, that we say seeing is believing, because we are wired to, in fact, for self-preservation. If I choose not to see the truck that's barreling down Florin Road, I won't live long. You flinch, or you duck, or you jump. When your brain perceives a threat. And I've mentioned in older videos that if I were to walk into my office and open the door and there was a snake, a Western rattlesnake in the middle of my office, my brain is not going to, the consciousness Congress is not going to send a command to the guy who's, and I love Inside Out, the little movie with the little control center, it's not going to sense like, oh, Paul, there's a snake in your office. I'm going to jump back before the conscious part of my brain has any notion of what's going on. And now, there are all sorts of examples like this that you can hear from Jordan Peterson or John Vervaeke or all kinds of the brain books that have been coming out for a while. And those brain books show us that we are, that the me, this autobiography, this story that I live through is not all of me. And again, as Augustine knew this, the Apostle Paul knew this, the author of the book of James knew this, who many think is James the Just, the brother of Jesus. Jesus knew this. Anybody who has watched human beings closely throughout the ages knows this, that we are disconnected from ourselves. But then you have the question, well, exactly who or what is trying to get in touch with yourself? And this is where we get into the question of the psyche or the soul or the story. And what actually am I? And is there actually a me that is working on this stuff? And so beliefs, just as one word, is too undifferentiated a word for what we're talking about. And so I'm going to split it into conscious subscriptions. Those are the beliefs that we attempt to profess, usually aspirationally, and axiomatic presuppositions. Now, these are absorbed from our environment. These are the kinds of things that, I forget what Roman Catholic monastic said, give me a child until they're six and I'll have them for the rest of their life. And the point is that you train that young elephant, and even when the elephant becomes large and great and strong, a lot of that stuff is built in. And so this is where we get some of these interesting questions about, you know, ideas about religious beliefs that get very, you know, if, you know, I grew up in a Christian household and I had wonderful Christian parents, and I've had tremendous experiences in church with religious people all my life. At a very deep level, I trust Dutch Calvinists. I trust Black folks. I trust certain groups of people because of where I was raised and how I grew up. Other people who had far more trauma in their childhood, who had bad experiences with religious communities, are they going to have a whole different set? And these will play off on their beliefs. But there's some of this stuff that's just simply baked in. So I had a conversation with Tim York, who has this amazing relationship with violin playing. Well, I started playing the violin when I was a first grader, and I played violin through high school. And then a few years ago, we didn't have any instruments in church because my small struggling church is a small struggling church. And so I pulled out my old student violin and I played it, but this violin isn't that good. But what everyone was in shock was, at least for those I was playing with, was that, well, I could play anything. Well, not anything. Any of the kind of music we play in church, which is usually a simple melody line, I can just play it by ear. I don't need any music. Well, why don't I need any music? Because from first grade to 10th grade, every day I played this instrument. And so even picking it up 40 years later, well, even though my body's a lot bigger than I was then, I can do it. And I can do it by ear. It's, you know, swimming, riding a bike, muscle memory, all of this stuff. It's not just muscle stuff. It's also how I feel. It's been built into me. You know, we talk about brain plasticity. Well, so much of that stuff is set. I am going to believe. And so now in the Jordan Peterson conversations with people who are not necessarily raised religious, they have a sense of, well, I don't feel God. Well, it's easy for me to feel God. Well, what exactly are you thinking? And what is God? And what are these beliefs? I mean, all of this stuff comes in. To me, it's very, very interesting. But some of this stuff is just built into me. And we can understand this from a scientific perspective, from a medical perspective, from a psychological perspective. So those are these axiomatic presuppositions, and they're coming to us from culture, and they're held communally. And again, I haven't played it for a while because every time I play it, Veritas Forum has it monetized, and I always get a little ding on my account, but it always annoys me. I like to have my videos free of those kind of things. And so, but Dallas Willard talks about the fact that we pick up our worldviews basically by picking up all the subtle cues of status. Oh, nobody in my environment talks about God. I'm not going to talk about God. Oh, I'm in a religious context. Everybody talks about God in this way. I'm going to talk about God in that way. Stuff just comes into us. The elephant is very much a herd animal, and the elephant is always watching the other elephants, and the riders are up there chattering, but the elephants are watching each other's elephant, and that's the old thing. Don't, you know, such and so, so and so is a liar because their lips are moving. Watch what they do, not what they say. And we learn this as herd animals. And then there's the firmware survival responses. Are these beliefs? That's really an interesting question. And so again, Jonathan Haidt's the rider and the elephant. The rider is the conscious agent who has status aspirations. And so there's probably a hierarchy of beliefs that are happening there, and things move around according to what the elephant sees the herd doing. The elephant has deeply herd-formed axiomatic responses. And so then if the rider wants to train the elephant, the rider really has to choose the herd that the elephant's going to be in. But, you know, that gets complex because if they're raised in a different herd and then they move to another herd, there's going to be influences going back and forth. Or as Jonathan Haidt makes the point in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, attend to the path. If you want to change the elephant, change his environment, because the elephant just absorbs things. And this, in fact, is part of the deep psychology behind church. Church is you have it in Christianity and Judaism and Islam, and also in other religions, you have a deep commitment to a community, and that community then shapes you. And so there are parts of me that are Dutch Calvinist that will be there until the day I die. There are parts of me that are connected to white society. There are parts of me that are connected to black society. And I don't even know that. And so again, Jordan Peterson's "watch yourself as if you were watching a stranger" is a helpful admonition in terms of trying to figure out who you are, because in many ways you can't, if What is the part of you that wants to change who you are when you want to change who you are? That's to be the Brett Weinstein story, because he's always saying, well, we've got this assassin program and we have to transcend the assassin programming. And every time I hear that, I thought, well, who did the programming for that part that wants to change the assassin robot programming? That's the, you know, this is where this stuff gets really weird. Like, you know, setting up a couple of mirrors, you just keep looking back into it. Dallas Willard was great on this stuff. And again, I wish I had Dallas Willard around for a bunch of this stuff. He's just he was a professor of philosophy at USC, did his work on Husserl phenomenology. But he, you know, he was an important voice in evangelical Christianity in North America, and deeply impacted John Ortberg, who is a pastor in Menlo Park Presbyterian near here, who was pastor at Willow Creek and is a celebrity pastor and a book writing pastor. But Dallas Willard often emphasized training, not trying. And when I read Jonathan Haidt's The Writer or the Happiness Hypothesis, that was, you know, very much the same way. Verveke talks about that too. The practices of your religious discipline. These practices shape you. And so you're shaping the elephant. And these are all ways, in a sense, for the rider to try to get a handle on the elephant. And as Peterson says, once the rider and the elephant are truly in sync, and if the rider really has mastery over the elephant, well, now you've got a war machine. Now you've got something powerful, because you have the reason of the rider and the wisdom, in a sense, of the elephant. Because that's really what the elephant has, is a lot of wisdom. And so you can sort of try to put the total package together. Now, obviously, we get to the question of beliefs and truth-seeking. We assume that there's a world outside the conscious self that impinges upon it. That's why, in fact, my body is very determined not to let me override the belief system that there's a truck barreling down Florin Road and I should not step in its path. That truck is real. And my physical body is real, even though I think in many ways a better description of me is that I'm a story, even though I have a physical body. And these two things are deeply intertwined. We get that in the Hebrew word nephesh. Conscious subscription and axiomatic presuppositions are necessary and unavoidable for human activity. We all have them. We all form them. And in fact, the axiomatic presuppositions are with us, but people almost always take on conscious subscriptions. They might be bad, they might be good, but that's a natural part of what we do. And I think it's a natural part of this capacity we have for going third person on ourselves, to watch ourselves as strangers. And so we have this necessity to take, it's sort of like Sauron's ring. We have this capacity to take a part of ourselves and put it outside of ourselves, so that, you know, that's a tremendously helpful tool, so that we can begin to say, okay, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'd like to do. And this gets into Augustine too. We are what we love, because what I'd like to do is a function of my desires. And usually we're in a community as the elephants, and we're watching ourselves. And this gets into some René Girard mimetic stuff, because all the elephants are paying attention to this one thing. And that must be the thing I should pay attention to. That should be the thing that I should aspire to become. And off we go in that. So all of this stuff is unavoidable. Conscious subscriptions, axiomatic presuppositions are necessary and unavoidable for human activities, and they must be stewarded. And again, the idea is, well, who exactly is doing the stewarding? And this is where, you know, with Jonathan Peugeot, you get into the conversation of principalities and powers, and you get into, like, I've been doing a lot in my Sunday school class, and I'm behind in posting my Sunday school class, but I should make some videos for my normal channel on this too. About things like school spirit. Well, a change of principle can change school spirit. We don't really know what we're talking about when we're talking about that. But we kind of know, but it's hard to put it into words. Well, there's a principality and power. These are ancient words, New Testament ways of talking about it. That in a sense, there's something that governs a community. And in the same way that I, in a sense, am multiple inside, we are multiple. And religious communities, Christianity, it's obviously the tradition I know best, talks about this all the time, in that we are the body of Christ. What do you mean by that? Well, all together we are one body. Well, what is required for that? Well, it's not dissimilar to saying, well, these are my aspirational beliefs, and these are the axiomatic presuppositions that we're working out. And the nice thing about having them in words is that we have at least a tool that, and it's a very imperfect tool, and we're always working on it. We have this tool by which we hopefully can reach our aspirations. And again, if you listen to Peterson long enough, he'll say, set a goal. It might be a bad goal. It might be a stupid goal. But even the task of setting a goal builds into you the capacity of pursuing a goal, which means you might actually get somewhere and arrive at something. And that's a good, good thing. And in fact, it's all these kinds of ways that humanity has, as a culture, been able to, we would say, progress. And we use, again, this A-B differentiation and testing within the iron box of secularism and say, yeah, eating is better than hunger, and so that's good. And being able to go to work and support your family is better than being a drunk, so that's good. And those are good little kind of gyroscopic guides which do, in Peterson-esque thinking, point outside of the iron box of secularism. But, you know, these things work pretty good, and they work good enough. And good enough, it always has its limits. That's the difficulty with pragmatism, is that it's a very valid observation within a limited framework. And because we're human beings, we're always limited, but you have difficulties with scale, which is why Newtonian mechanics is good for small things, but you get very large and very small, and Newtonian mechanics breaks down, and so we keep pushing the edges. And usually when we find, as we keep pushing the edges, we find things that are helpful. So, conscious subscription, axiomatic presuppositions are necessary and unavoidable for human activity, which must be stewarded. And then we have the problem of the watch self, which I already mentioned. Every time Brett Weinstein talks about transcending our programming, I think, exactly what program is transcending the other program? Because that's the question to ask. And if you read C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, that's the question that those three rather brief essays really touch on. And I highly recommend it. Now, in order to do this, speech diversity is helpful, and this is a war that's being waged. We need to be able to talk, and we have a problem when we prematurely science or ostracize. And as a pastor, this is something that I know. When I have a small group, when I have a small group meeting, I usually tell people that no honest expression is out of bounds here. If you hate God or want to cuss him out, well, cussing that might just be a little bit more self-indulgent than necessarily helpful for group participation, but you need belief diversity in order to, that's the whole order chaos thing, you need belief diversity in order to actually be able to weigh and test the beliefs. There might be some things you haven't thought of, and even the process from Old Testament to New Testament, from going from whatever you want to call Old Testament religion to Christianity, I mean Jesus tremendously stretches some aspects of the old covenant, and then you have the question, well, that kind of tension is what makes the sound beautiful in a violin string. I'll say it that way. Free speech is important, and I think Peterson is dead on right about idea death. It's better for our ideas to die than us to die, so free speech is actually important. And a lot of the things that we enjoy in Western democracy, free speech, diversity of opinion, representative democracy, these are all, in a sense, pragmatic solutions to enduring problems in humanity. And we might get a number of things terribly wrong, but at least there's the possibility for improvement. And so, these are not bad systems, and these systems have worked out fairly well. All of this depends, however, on a culture replete with communal consciousness subscriptions and communal axiomatic presuppositions. And when David Brooks was writing today about, you know, corruption and moral, Brooks has a new book out. I haven't read it yet. I saw the piece on PBS. I mean, there's fiber to all this, and this is where we get into the principalities and the principalities of our culture, that cultures have sets of values in hierarchies, and they're acted out axiomatically, and then there are these conscious subscriptions to them. And so in American culture, we have all of these, all men are created equal. There's a conscious subscription. No one is above the law. There's a conscious subscription. We have all of these conscious subscriptions, and then we have these axiomatic presuppositions, and all of this is in play for us as a body politic. And again, this is in many ways something inherited from Christian language with respect to the body of Christ. So all of this stuff is working. So do we choose our beliefs? Well, yes and no. It depends on what you mean by beliefs. I think this was my last slide. Yeah, it was. So there's a 40 minutes. That's not too bad for me. There's a little video. Hopefully, contribute to the conversation about beliefs, because again, as a pastor, pastors have a lot of experience with this area of beliefs in individuals, beliefs in communities, beliefs in bodies, and I hope it's helpful.